I just looked at my little panel over here, and we have actually the progress of our lesson. Kind of talk about evolution, that's up till 25, and then we have John R. Rice, sort of fits in our period where we're in today, the fundamentalist. Then we have the neo-evangelicals with Billy Graham and Fuller and Hockengay. And then we have the New Testament criticism by Ladd. So that's kind of our pattern without really meaning to do that, but that's kind of our lesson plan as we go forward. And so today's lesson is, oh, by the way, thanks for coming. I always got to tell you that. I do appreciate it. Today's lesson is a finish up of last week, which I never hate. I hate to do that because you sort of get, you know. So it is, we did what we did finish last week, and then I finished up what we're going to do in this period of time between 1925 and 1950. So that should set us up to go into the even neo-evangelical age or the period that leads up to it, which would be in the 40s. So actually, we are really making progress. And so on. Fifth lesson of the 10, so we got five more after today for this season. As I said, this is the fifth week of our investigation of the 20th century fundamentalist-modernist controversy, which really started in 1850, really, but you know it really heated up around 1900 and came to a boiling point in 1925. So we had that 50-year period, 45, probably 1875 to 1925, that 50-year period where this controversy went on. First of all, it was internal, and then it kind of bubbled out in the open where actually people left churches, started new churches, and so forth, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. The modernists have abandoned the authority of Scripture, remember, with Schleiermacher, and then we have also Waldhausen, another German, to undermine the authority of Scripture, the confidence in Scripture. The modernists, sometimes called now the liberals, modernists are the denominational churches that come out of the Reformation, so we have the Presbyterian Church, the Methodist Church, a Congregational Church generally, I'm missing a few in here. Lutheran Church kind of stands off by itself, they never get amalgamated into the overall thing, because they're, I don't know why, but they are so strong in their polity that they pretty well are a history of their own. So the mainline churches that apostatize, and it takes a while for the believers in the mainline churches to see what's going on, and they jump off and start their own. So we make that point in 1925. Now these denominational churches have not ceased to be religious, but double down on their Christian version of morality. Sometimes we call it ethics. They gave up on the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ as theologically unacceptable, and therefore it was really removed from Christianity, and that left you liberalism as it is even today. Since the Bible is no longer an authority, just a little bit historical, authority, new discoveries put science in its place. Science becomes capital S because science can explain things better than the Bible because the Bible is just full of superstition, so it's really not reliable. And there's many mistakes in it anyway, but science, it's got the right story. So science has solved the problems of origin by adopting the ideas made popular by Darwin. Didn't make them up. They came from Greek mythology. Darwin just was at the right place at the right time. So the believers of Orthodox Christianity, also known as the fundamentalists, mobilized to oppose this teaching of evolution in the public schools, and the showdown between the two sides is set up in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925, and that's what we had last 2 weeks. The trial is a circus, however, in the trial the defendant switches to plead guilty to the charge, in effect shuts down the trial. The verdict is rendered and invalid, overturned on our technicality, on grounds not merits of the case. So it's kind of like a nothing burger. As a result, there's nothing for further appeal. The appeals court sees the whole thing as a charade, throws the whole thing out of court, and everybody's tired, and that's where it stays. Except the press makes fun of this famous lawyer from Nebraska for his prosecution. His called-on testimony, unusual, a prosecuting attorney is called on as a witness for the defense. His testimony is weak. He has made a laughing stock and is in his flawed historic account. So it goes. So our lesson picks up on the aftermath of the trial as it relates to the fundamentalists in the next 20 years, 25 to 40 or whatever, 25, 30 to 50, somewhere in there. These lines are not fast. But the fundamentalists believe the flawed account of the Scopes event. The fundamentalists believe the flawed account of the Scopes event. Some turn bitter, feel victimized by the system, and fight back. And there were those that kind of look ugly. There's a reaction by the moderates who believe in order to win America. Now, I'm doing moderates within the fundamentalists now. The moderates who believe in order to win America, reforming fundamentalism is the way to resolve these negatives of the separatists and their attitudes and their activities. So there's three issues here. They separated themselves. They don't like that. Also, it is imperative that they improve credibility as serious evangelical scholars. No one's listening to them because we are now a laughing stock. And then we also have this real issue of social problems of the day that really need to be solved. And I came to that and I thought, how long ago now had the social problems been around? Is there any movement that they're being solved? No. Do you think that's not true? Are the social problems being solved today? No. Interesting thought. Anyway, three things. Issue of separatists, separatism, issue of lack of scholarship, and we need to do something about the Poe, or whatever they are, whoever the social problems are. So the flaw by this Allen, I do not know who he is, just read this. It is easier for him to quote somebody or quote him rather than do your own research, which is what happened after the monkey trial. F. L. Allen, in his paper, an article only yesterday, 1931, has suggested that Darrow's grilling of Bryan was so effective that it made a laughingstock of the fundamentalist cause and put an end to the anti-evolution campaign across America. And many commentators picked up on that story, followed it. He was editor of the Harper's Magazine, published a commentary in which Darrow and Bryan confrontation was depicted as a defeat for Bryan and a defeat for anti-evolutionism. The reality is somewhat different. Now, it took decades for this to come out, sometime in the 1980s, 1990s, that's all long. However, the reality was that Allen was no historian, and his account of the event was seriously flawed. For example, the teaching of evolution in American schools went down rapidly following the Scopes trial. Nevertheless, Allen's erroneous version of the facts was repeated in subsequent books of a similar nature for decades thereafter, eventually finding its way in the late 1950s into college textbooks on American history and popular culture in the movie of the 1960s, Inherit the Wind. How many have seen that movie? That's amazing. Inherit the Wind? Well, you got to watch it for entertainment. But what it shows is what the perception was of the Scopes trial. And it totally rearranged facts. Only two of you. Well, I thought there might be more. Shows your age. Now, another guy I know of this name, but I don't know of him except from years ago. He was older then already, so now he's gone, 1986. The best the fundamentalists could say for themselves was, in the words of North Carolina Baptist preacher Vance Havner, that just because the great broadcast chains do not carry our message and because popular periodicals give us no space, it is not to be deduced that we are bound for extinction. There were still many old-fashioned Christians around, Havner pointed out, who have not bowed to the modern Baal. It was the ages moderns who felt frantic self-wounders, not the fundamentalists. Echoing the apostle's word to the Philippian jailer, Havner equipped that the fundamentalists would say to the bewildered age, do thyself no harm, we are still here, which is the right answer. But where is here? Simply put, the fundamentalist in the 1930s and 40s was not to be found primarily in the broken ranks, the inner fights, of the anti-modernist crusades, or in, was it limited to the small alienated groups of the separatists that you might think of, or the big super churches? There weren't very many of those empires compared to what we have today, of some of the chieftains. Fundamentalism, and here has been my premise I've been experimenting with, and now he says it, fundamentalism was a popular movement, and as such, its strength was not to be measured according to the degree of its organizational unity. All right, now I've said it a little differently. I said it this way. If a grassrooted Christianity, influenced simply by his presence, that is, his normal living, does not hinder or stop the advance of unrighteousness in society, a Christian-sponsored state law or anything else he does overtly, structurally, organizationally, will do nothing except antagonize the opposition. So I think this is what he says here. Not to be measured according to the degree of organizational unity. My premise is that we just need to live as Christians, and God does the rest. Don't have to be organized, because that's a man's way of doing things. Doesn't mean there can't be organization, but we're not going to get it done by organization. It happens as salt and light in the earth, and as far as I know, light and salt are not very well organized. Okay, movements commonly have internal variations, which is true of the fundamentalist intentions, and this is not a sign of declination so much as vitality. For movements like patches of dandelions grow and spread when they are agitated. All right, movements have horizontal, web-like, informal lines of leadership, organization, not vertical, pyramid-like. They just function, as I've said. Look for evolution. Look for evolutionary art graphics. They're always made fun of, as far as I can tell. I mean, there just really isn't anything serious about evolution that you can say, no, that's serious. It always comes out kind of like a joke, like this. Start with an ape and end with Darth Vader. So we're tracing now what happened after the Scopes trial, and the idea has been the fundamentalists just took it, and they're just down, and they're defeated, and they're never going to rise again. It's all over. They just will close their churches and go home. That's what you're meant to think. On the contrary, the legal maneuvers came to an end because the battle to extinguish the teaching and evolution in schools were virtually, although temporarily, won without the need for such draconian legal measures. Now I have on this side, on my right, is a typical one of the pages in the book that Scopes supposedly taught from, page 193. And you notice that it has these layers, just to notice, these are layers, geological layers, that show these are the oldest and these are the youngest. And when you find these animal skeletons in these layers, you know what time it is, what time of age it is. And Brian says you don't know these ages until you know how old the animal is, and you don't know how old the animal is until you know what layer it's found in, and that's kind of a joke. Well, anyway, this is one of the things, and that geographic column, geological column, does not exist in nature. You find these species all over, and then you put them together by some idea that you think will work. All right, so that was part of that book. In 1926, the superintendent of education in the state of Louisiana demanded the removal of 6 pages of this book on evolution from Hunter Civic Biologist, what it's called. The textbook featured in Scopes trial and most popular biology textbook use in high school nationwide. He asked them to be removed, demanded they be removed. Sure enough, when the book was released as new edition in 1927, retitled A New Civic Botany, the offending pages had been rewritten. The title Doctrine of Evolution had been removed along with the charts and pages 193, which is one of those pages I just showed you, and 194, showing alleged evolutionary sequences. In fact, even the word evolution had been changed to development whenever it occurred. The one remaining potential hotspot, the reference to man's scientific definition as a member of the taxonomic class of mammals, mammalia, was tempered by the assurance that man is the only creature that has moral and religious instincts. The text of John Scopes himself used, A Civic Biology, contained only 3 pages on evolution in 1914 and was then renamed New Civic Biology in 1926. Nearly all explicit references to the evolution were removed entirely. Gebener and Miller, whoever they are, even argued that you could effectively date a science text by being written after rather than before 1925 simply by looking in the index and seeing if evolution is missing. Now, we're told that the monkey trial was totally against the fundamentalist. We're seeing evidence to the opposite. And remember, I said it was temporary. Throughout the 1920s and 30s, fundamentalists were largely successful in purging evolution from the science classes, although they were not able to accomplish much when it came to having creationism introduced as a replacement. Now, I have no problem with that. I mean, I don't think we should have any problem with that because we are talking immediately we move outside of science with origins. It is outside of science. But we should leave that to the churches, leave it to theology. And remember last week we talked about this reason we can't do without evolution is because these poor students are going to be ill-equipped, ill-preparing them to be scientific and on technological changes, they'll be left behind. And I ask again, what is it they're missing? What scientific knowledge or expansion is lost to students who work from a Christian base rather from a atheistic or agnostic base? And you were really quiet last week, and maybe you had a week to think about it, and it came up with some ideas that maybe if they didn't know about evolution, they would not be able to solve this problem. Now, we remember, we can't talk about origins. That's not a scientific question. That's a theological question. And I won't need to spend a lot of time waiting for an answer because there isn't any. It's always what they're going to find out that you're going to need. What you're going to find out, that's what you're going to need, but we don't have it yet, like the branches of the tree. They're not fully filled in yet, but when they will be, we'll understand it all. Well, we're still waiting, according to Mr. Osborne from the paper, article in the paper 1925, we're still waiting for those branches to fill in, those links to fill in, and they haven't yet. And the links they think have filled in have been a joke, like the Nebraska man, the big tooth. So I can think of no science that has been hampered by believing in a creating God. Most of the early scientists worked from a Christian base. Everybody knows that. In fact, that was the intellectual property of humanity, was within Christianity. No science can deal with origins because theories are not verifiable or repeatable. The big question falls outside true science. It is a theologian's discipline. Now get that in our head, and we don't need to teach this stuff in our public schools. All right, so just an object that does not speak. Fossils really don't speak. To determine the origin of an object, one must rely on clues or direct information. The earthquake in Galilee assumed to be around 747 AD, this one I happen to know about, but that date was corrected when a skeleton was found holding a coin. Now, it wasn't dated 749. It was just that the king that was in it was ruling at that point. I just put it that way so you understand what we're doing here. So they knew it had to be at that date or later. So we need something like that to date our origins if we're going to have scientific information. We have to somebody tell us some written thing that says the same thing to all people. The only place that is found is in the Bible. In the world is in the Bible. Besides that, there are scientific clues that severely limit the age of the earth. If you go look at science or what looks like what's left over from scientific observation, it looks young, not old. So these are ones we think of as Christian scientists. These are the ones that changed our lives. And they are, at that time, respected as the intellectuals of their day. So creationism did not confuse the scientists. It gave them confidence that following laws of consistency, they were able to learn about creation by discovery and application of laws that always existed. The law of predictability, not randomness. They believed that the functions of nature were not random events, but highly restricted set of predictable laws that could be understood to explain why things are the way they are. The laws of science and the will of God, in a sense, are the same thing. Remember in 2 Samuel chapter 8 or 7, somewhere in there, 6. When Uzzah reached out to touch the ark on the way to Jerusalem, when David was capturing it, bringing it back after it had been captured, trying to keep it from falling off the cart, God's law took effect and killed Uzzah just like an electric charge. Uzzah's honorable intention did not set aside the law of God. So this is not a bad thing. We might think, oh, poor Uzzah, shouldn't have done it. That's true, and God should have given an exception here, you know, because set aside the laws just for this time. Remember, God said, don't touch it. And that's like a law of electricity. Don't touch it. Right? This is not a bad thing. It is a good thing because God is predictable. We are in Christianity, we are the only ones to have a God that's predictable. Now, that means that something's happened bad if you go against his will, but it's a real comfort to know that the same outcome always occurs in laws of science or of nature, we call it, God's law. So these are treasures. We just know how to live within them. Uzzah made a mistake. Intentionally or not, he made a mistake and the laws applied to him. So God has warned the human race what he will do, which is really a comfort to us. The world's out there hoping he won't do what he said he will do. And we say, I hope he does what he does. Will do what he says he will do because my life depends on it. Remember, Amos says, prepare to meet your God. And so God says to us, prepare to meet him. That's a law. Although the press mostly chose to pillory Brian, his own followers seem to have regarded his performance as highly admirable. Indeed, far from losing momentum, even after Brian's death, the fundamentalist cause went from strength to strength. So I just thought, I know that in a lot of the courthouses across the land, there are references to the law, Bible events, particularly Moses because of the law. And on Supreme Court freeze, we have Moses with the Ten Commandments, done after the Scopes trial. Is getting the idea that maybe Moses is losing favor with the world, with America? Not a bit. On the Supreme Court, we still see him. And on lots of courts across county courthouses, across the land, in courthouses, you still see this. Now, we know the ACLU is trying to get rid of them, but it's going to be difficult to get rid of the Supreme Court. I mean, there's going to be some whatever problems. But what I'm saying here is that we don't have the American people shrugging from the Bible at this point. And we're 10 years after the Scopes trial. You think, well, you know, we probably shouldn't be doing that. You know, after all, it's kind of controversy. They just put it up on the Supreme Court freeze. All right, so fundamentalists, what they hold for, is not in that bad shape. So just 3 days after Brian died, an anti-evolutionary bill was put into the Georgia State Legislature. In 1926, similar bills were presented to 3 more state assemblies. And in 1927, no less than 18 different anti-evolutionary bills were submitted in 14 states. Now, they didn't pass, but the idea that they're put up indicates what interest is. Overall, 2/3 of all anti-evolutionist political activity in the 1920s occurred after the Scopes trial. So who is winning here? All right. So we can talk about the aftermath. Christianity is not dead. I don't know how many times I've read over the years that Christianity has been declared dead. You know, different philosophers have said that. So we have another opportunity. That Christianity is dead or must change in order to maintain relevance is an old saw that keeps coming back. Schleiermacher thought that he was saving Christianity by making it a milquetoast variety of the real thing. Others, as did Julius Wellhausen, instead of giving us Moses, he gave us JPED writers. They represent writers like Yahweh, the priestly, Elohim, Deuteronomy writers. So they actually aren't names. They're kind of more positions. So he took away a real writer and gave us fictitious ones. So by doing this, he was trying to rescue Christianity. Because we know that Moses could not have written it. So who did? Well, these guys, we don't know who they are, but these are the letters we're going to assign to them. So this was going on because Christianity is dead. Now they're trying to save it. But the work of God continues to rise inexplicably to achieve exactly what the Lord has ordained. So the conclusion that fundamentalism was dying by 1930 has been based on a variety of perceptions, notably those formed by the movement's opponents, even by the fundamentalist leaders themselves, they got to be looking at themselves like they're doing something wrong. And more recently, by our Allen-type historians. A major problem was, in the wake of the Scopes trial, the Christian Century described the fundamentalist movement as an event now past. Rest in peace. A brief dysfunctional mutation away from the main line of religious evolution. Why is it that the left loves the idea of evolution, the progress, progressives, the hope of change, rather than the conservative, conserve what we have? The real objective is never defined, progress, or how to arrive at it except in philosophical terms like, well, we want equality for all. We want no want. We want no division, no distinctions, no borders, not borders, no borders. Even John Lennon's song, Imagine, sums it up. So why is progressing to an unknown, untried end so attractive? It borders on the demonic supernatural for an explanation of its popularity. So many observers would go further and judge that fundamentalism was rapidly declining and would soon die out altogether. Indeed, for the intellectual, the movement was a retreat. Without a doubt, it had lost influence and respect in some quarters, yet fundamentalism remained a viable grassroots religious movement and it prospered as such in the 1930s in spite of its defeats and disgraces. Walter Lippmann observed that the fundamentalist idea no longer appealed to the best brains and the good sense of the modern community. He's probably right. While it has certainly suffered from external defeats and a variety of internal fractures and strains and contributed few, if any, fresh and powerful ideas, fundamentalism provided a believable faith and a strong, lively religious community for hundreds of thousands, and I might say millions, in the 1930s and the 40s. So I must point out here that fresh and powerful ideas floated to save Christianity were the very ideas that were the roots of attack. You know, we're going to talk about scholarship in lessons to come. Somehow scholarship is looked at as being our savior, and the scholarship that they intend means that scholars undermine the scriptures. Why would we want some more scholarship that wouldn't undermine the scriptures? The fundamentalists contribute nothing to scholarship because scholarship undermines the scriptures. So that's why we don't, you know, have scholars, because by definition, scholarship is intended to undermine scriptures. Otherwise, it's not scholarship. So Christianity doesn't need fresh new ideas to stay alive, does it? It needs to recover the old ideas once for all delivered to the saint, Jude says. Indeed, the movement's success posed a double irony. While the liberal Protestant spokesman smugly predicted that such belated forms of religious life would gradually be starved out, their own mainline Protestant denomination suffered a severe religious depression during the 1930s. At the same time, the fundamentalists who talked melodramatically about being tiny and despised minority prospered. So if we are to see how fundamentalism was doing in the 30s, we must explore the major networks of cooperation, the grid of institutions bequeathed to it by the revivalists and the premillennial pre-tribulational trap passages, evangelists, missions leaders, Bible teachers who had laid the foundation of the movement at the turn of the century. Remember, I drew on the board last week, I think it's off there, moored on the board that this church are my generation and your generation are the inheritors of what they planted. And my concern is, making contributions to the next generation as something to grow on? So ours comes from this generation, these fundamentalists. In fact, somehow we'll try to pull us all together someday, but that's just the way it is. Okay. Because, you know, the contribution was made in the 30s, but the benefit of it came 20, 30 years later. If these men have been trained, comes to be pastors in our churches. Lehman Strauss was a pastor. Gil sat under Lehman Strauss's ministry. Well, Lehman Strauss would have been one of these guys. Okay, so we are the benefactors of this period. All right, Christianity cannot be stopped. How was this fundamentalist enterprise faring during the 30s? Was it thriving, growing, It was thriving and growing. Its network of institutions was expanding in order to accommodate the movement's demand for trained leaders, popular religious knowledge, and vehicles for evangelism. I just showed you a bunch of schools here. As we hand off our study to the next section, we must not conclude that fundamentalism is killed by trial, the press, or anti-Christian attitudes. We also must remember that victory is being what God wants us to be. Doesn't seem like victory sometimes. It should be no surprise to Bible believers that we will be in the minority all of the time. But winning what God wants us to win. So there are no regrets about the trial or any setbacks assessed. The advancement of the gospel according to God's perfect plan, it continues unabated. We too are susceptible to the negative press when we read negative news, and I could tell you a story about that in our church. When they come to do a nice story about the church, they come out and tell us something that's not nice and it gets in the press. We don't like that. We're victims of it. Can't help it. We can't help it. They just do what they do. But the real news is not in the headlines or in the bylines, nor does it always make print, as Vance Havner said. But we are assured that progress to the millennial kingdom is sure and will not arrive 1 second late. So we go eventually to Charles Fuller. We could pick him up here now, but we're going to leave it till next week. The radio aspect of the spirit, radio ministry at this period is big. I want to leave it as a separate subject, or not, then I don't want to work it in tonight. But I just love his book written by his son, who was apostate, but his father, and he called the book, Give the Winds a Mighty Voice, Jesus Saves, Jesus Saves. And, you know, for the radio, that radio voice, you know, you put it out on the winds, so the winds have a mighty voice in his father. I just think it's neat. Jesus Saved was his theme song. We sing it once in a while. Now, for those of us who grew up in an era finding nothing new in the doctrine of separation, and I did. I grew up in a Mennonite, and we were odd people anyway. Well, according to the community we were, I've never felt accepted by anybody in terms of the culture. So that, to me, has never been something I've had to adjust to. Always lived that way. So in a way, it's a preparation. You get used to it. Those of us who came out of mainline churches in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s may well have understood the cold wind felt in the criticism of attending an independent church. The question of ultimate authority always comes up or came up in an independent church, so it was dubious. It's got to be a cult or a cult-like. One of our friends even said that. In Hills, not a cult, but it's cult-like. Because it has no roots. So who do you answer to? You know, what larger body you go to settle questions. We got a board. Yeah, but what about, and you know how it goes. So modernism national organizations within the domination declined. I've said that to you before. But fundamentalists' vigor ensured that the segment of American Protestants was one of the few that was growing during the 30s. It was not until decades later when fundamentalists and their evangelical heirs reemerged in American life that many observers noticed the growth of it and took notice of it. I remember, was it 1976 was the year of the evangelical? I mean, I like the connotation of that, but it was finally made the front page of Time magazine 50 years later. Now, I got some problems with that, but, you know, in terms of public, I'm going to skip these because this is just my outline where we're going to go. Don't read it to you and then do it again. So, first one here, churches formed. The fundamentalists are separating to form new independent or new denominational churches with less traditional control. We didn't have to go back to the Reformation to prove something. The Independent Fundamental Church of America was founded in 1930. Name was changed later to IFCA. It is an associate of nearly 1,000 independent Protestant churches located largely in the United States and up to 3,000, that number of associated churches in 26 countries outside the United States. The fundamentalists are separating to form new churches. I read that and continue. IFCA has 1,100 individual members. I don't know what the date of this is on Wiki. 1,100 individual members, pastors, missionaries, professors, church planters, chaplains, other vocational Christian workers. In the United States, there are 5 member colleges, Bible classes, 11 home missions agencies, 12 church planning agencies. It also has 8 foreign mission agencies ministering outside the United States. This is IFCA, one organization. The church followed ethnic or immigration lines. Now we talk about these churches that are formed. When I grew up, there was the Swedish church, there was the Danish church, there was the German church, Dutch church. All that's gone now, but they had that identification back in those days because so many of these people were immigrants. And they named their churches after the immigration because sometimes they even spoke the mother language there. When I grew up, they still spoke German in the early service. I never did learn to speak German like that. Church followed ethnic or immigration lines like Swedish, Danish, German, Dutch. The most common would have been Baptist ethnicity. And I'm going to mention Luther just because they were there, but they never got melted with the rest. They continue to be Lutherans, or Lutherans always. Baptist, we have the Conservative, the General, Associated Regular Baptist, the General Baptist, the Independent Baptist, the Free Will Baptist, the Church of the Brethren, the Grace Brethren came out of that. Evangelical Free Church was out of the Swedish Evangelical, joined with the Norwegian Danish Church, made the Free Church, which we have down this road here in Lincoln. We have the Southern Baptist churches, where slavery was an issue, divided the North from the South. We have the Pentecostal churches that started after 1900, the Assemblies of God. Other churches, many of them, a lot of them are independent. The Nazarene and the churches like them, holiness churches, the Wesleyan movement, Free Methodists. These are churches that basically come out of this period. Very evangelical Mennonites arrived as immigrants and not involved in the fundamentalist battle. They were kind of like Lutherans off by themselves. But some of them came out to start evangelical schools. We had like Grace College of the Bible in Omaha and Tabor College, where I went for a year and a half. We started in 1908. We're not going to spend time on here, but we have these coming from Catholic Christendom, Church of England, Lutheranism, Calvinism, the radical sects. So we fit under the radical sects because of the Anabaptists. So the Anabaptists, we have the Baptists here, and we have all these groups that come out of it. I just read a bunch of these. All those that are listed are not here, but basically this is the point where they come from. Many, many churches. In fact, you go down phone book and link it, I bet you'd find probably more churches that have roots from this time than were traditional roots, although you have a lot of Methodist Church and Presbyterian churches that still exist. That was churches. Now schools. Schools started outside. Remember, this is during that 30s or leading up to the 30s. Remember, the lines aren't totally solid. Schools started outside the mainline denomination, then they flourished. In the old order, the fundamentalists are in control of the new separated churches. They have to fight everybody all the time. They do what they wanted to do. They could be pre-trib, pre-mill, without having to have votes all the time and get voted out of office. So they're in control of these separating schools, run by the more than likely democratically controlled church authorities. Churches, a lot of times in America, were democratically elected offices. And they're more likely Arminian than Calvinistic, more likely, although they're both there. Bible institutes, many ended up preparing men for a pulpit, although they didn't intend that. That's what they did because there was a demand for it. The old Sabbath churches still produced the educator ministries, but few survived the rigors of modernism. Very few went to Yale and Harvard and Princeton most for a while because they got corrupted. Therefore, fundamentalism began their own seminaries. And there's a bunch more. I'm thinking a lot of things I'm going to miss here, but Dallas Seminary was not the earliest one. We have Trinity Seminary, 1897, Western Seminary, 1927, Talbot, 1950, the late one, Dallas Seminary, 1924. And Princeton was the last of the Presbyterians that stayed faithful, but they fell in this period of time. A lot of schools being prepared. So we have at least 50 schools, according to one report, that serve fundamentalist constituencies. Well, some, like the Detroit Bible College, were little more than evening classes run out of the local church for training Sunday school teachers. We still have contact with the Detroit institution up there. I don't know if anybody here I could ask. I know we have some books written by some of those men. I don't know if it's this actual school or not. But there's a school up in Detroit. Okay, now the schools. The largest and the most important of the fundamentalist Bible institutes of the early 1930s were the Bible Institute of Los Angeles, Biola, Gordon College of Theology Missions, Boston, Moody Bible Institute, Chicago, National Bible Institute of New York, Northwestern Bible Missionary, Minneapolis, talked about that with Riley, the NIAC Missionary Training Institute of NIAC on the Hudson, New York, Philadelphia College of Bible, where Gil went, Bible Institute of Pennsylvania, also in Philadelphia. Two other schools that were founded in the 1920s but were developing rapidly were Columbia Bible College in South Carolina and Prairie Bible Institute of Three Hills, Alberta. You went there, right? Many of the independent churches teach the fundamentals are pre-mill, pre-trib. I've said that many times. In their hermeneutics and eschatology, without having a structure. They all read the Bibles the same way. While there were no organic structures, as in the domination, the Bible Conference movement, the Schofield Bible, the Fundamentals of the Faith books, the schools sending conference speakers to the churches by the hundreds, gave a unified look to the pre-mill, pre-trib theology was what was widely embraced. Missions. Independent, like schools, missions carried the gospel to the heathen world. This is one of the last things that happened, because missions stayed with the mainline churches until they found out their money was going to social work somewhere, and they pulled out and established their own missions. So we have new missions like TEAM, the Evangelical Alliance Mission. We have the Sudan Interior Missions, SIM, New Tribes Missions, Wycliffe Missions, China and Lynn Missions, Greater European Missions, New Tribes Missions. Did I do that already? Yeah, I did that twice. Now, there are a bunch more. I'm going by memory here, and I don't have any way to look up and list of them. There are lists, but I didn't have time. All right, so there are more, so you might want to add some. Now, missions even to schools, InterVarsity, Campus Crusade, Navigators, all came out of this period. By 1933, after 20 years of experience, two Bible schools in Philadelphia had produced some 150 missionaries. By its 21st year, 1944, Columbia Bible College in South Carolina produced 135. The Northwestern Bible Missionary Training School in Minneapolis accounted 110 alumni missionaries in 1936, while in 1938, the Bible Institute of Los Angeles had produced 426 and over 120 in the last decade. A lot of people were sent out into the mission field as trained missionaries. The most productive training ground for foreign missions, however, was Moody Bible Institute, the self-proclaimed West Point of Christian Service. Between 1932 and 1942, at least 500 MBI alumni became missionaries, which brought the school's total missionary production since its founding to 2,400 some odd. 1936, there were 142 people enrolled in Moody's missions course. 1,400 Moody alumni were active missionaries. These workers constituted nearly 12% of the reported total North American Protestant force. Moody was a great force. Entrepreneurs. Another issue, the number five now, we're going down the list of areas of influence. Entrepreneurs without church restraints published literature, books, magazines, evangelical Sunday school curriculum. And the publishing houses like Erdman's, Zondervan, David C. Cook, Gospel Light, InterVarsity, Sunday School Times, Fleming Ravel, Loazo Brothers, Moody Press, Moody Monthly, Our Hope, Gabriel Ein, Barnhouse, Presbyterian Revelation, Sword of the Lord, and by John R. Rice. And I'm sure that's just a touching on few of the publishing houses that were putting out literature. Number six, the Ministry of Revival or conferences. I grew up with them in our church. We'd have them in the fall and have them in the spring. There's something called evangelistic meetings, usually more than Bible conferences. It became a standard practice, for example, for these schools to host. The schools now, remember, sent these pastors out, teachers out to these churches. It became standard practice, for example, for the schools to host week-long, evangelistic missionary or Bible conferences. They were open to the public. A lot of people got saved during those times. I got saved in one of those kind of events. Some of the larger schools also had what were known as extension departments. These offices sent out field representatives to organize Bible conferences and revival meetings off-site and provide churches with guest preachers. The Moody Extension Department held weekend Bible conferences in nearly 500 churches during 1936. You can see now, if you come out with one theology and it's taught in all these churches, you see there's a unity to everything without there being an organization. That's what the beauty of the whole thing is. Okay, which doubled efforts 6 years before. Okay, this survey should dispel any doubt about the vitality of fundamentalism in the wake of the public dealings in the 1920s, defeats in the 1920s. The movement was thriving. It was developing a complex and widespread institutional network to sustain its activity. Indeed, perhaps the best way to think about the fundamentalist movement and its location in the American social culture and religious landscape is to remember that these interconnections, these ties between people and institutions, the collective interests and the concerns being expressed, the mutual involvement in religious projects, there's a verb in there somewhere. These different kinds of fundamentalist activity, education, conferencing, publishing, radio broadcasting, evangelism, each connect individual and congregations to endeavors of a larger scope. That's what I tried to say before about these guys go out, but there's no organization, but they're all tied together informally. Like overlaid map transparency showing the highways, railroads, waterways, air routes, communication lines that connect a modern society, each kind of collective undertaking gave fundamentalism another layer of infrastructure as a movement. Informal. That's why I say when God does it, he does it without the way we usually do it. The success of fundamentalism and other evangelical groups also grew very rapidly during the 30s and 40s, came at the very time that mainline Protestantism was experiencing a decline. Yet there was not a general religious depression during the 1930s, as was supposed, but a crisis mainly among the older, more prestigious denominations. At the same time, almost every mainline Protestant denomination declined in membership, baptism, Sunday school enrollment, total receipts, and foreign missions. Fundamentalists surged out of the older institutional structures, partly out of the protest and alienation, but also because they wished to do many things not possible within mainline Protestantism. And to that extent, the whole thing is a blessing. They shook off all those freeloaders. So we come, 10 minutes short or long, to the radio part, which we want to deal with next week. And it's good because I was going to go one way and I read some more this afternoon. I can't go that way. I got to back up and do it again. Some of you probably don't remember Carl McIntyre, although he was a later guy. He ministered into the 70s. And he is probably the quintessential guy that these neo-evangelicals had in mind when they said, we got to do it a better way. Because he was a nasty guy in a way, you know. He was a nice guy, but not difficult to deal with, you know. You know what a Ron Paul is? You know, it's got to be my way or no way. He go to meetings and he say, what'd you guys decide? Dot, dot, dot. No, you can't do that. You got to change the meeting because I'm here now. We got to change what you decided because I'm here. I mean, that didn't work very good for groups. That's just not very, very good. So anyway, McIntyre sort of is a spoiler, I think. And the reason I had to go back, I thought he had more influence earlier, but his influence came later. So I can't really blame him for the problem. But the problem that he represents is there already in the